Welcome to the Mindwaves podcast. I'm your host, Rosie, and in each episode I'll be sharing positive news, stories and information about mental health in Greater Glasgow and Clyde. This is the third in our three-part series looking at the effects of the menopause on mental health and well-being. We will be talking to three women with different experiences of the menopause. The menopause can feel very isolating. While everyone will experience it in unique ways, it is known to affect many aspects, including work, social life, and mental well-being. To combat this feeling of isolation and the lack of information, many organisations have been set up to help, some specialising in specific groups, such as early onset and LGBTQ+ communities. Today we are speaking to Helen Douglas.
My name is Helen Douglas, and I'm an author, editor, and research associate. And I spend most of my time at the moment looking at the intersection of menopause and trauma and neurodiversity.
Wow, fantastic. That is a very interesting subject. It's a very interesting set of subjects. How did you get into those areas?
Purely, I think it's just whether it was serendipity or just a result of trying to find my way through a whole jungle of issues. So I was diagnosed as being autistic when I was 48. And sort of, you know, that came at the end of, you know, a whole raft of things related to surgery and ongoing mental health challenges. Like so many, I wanted answers. I was seeking to understand myself. Given my background was in research anyway, it just seemed like the natural thing to go into that area. So it was, it's serendipity, I think.
I wondered if we would start at the beginning. Was there much discussion of the menopause when you were young, when you were growing up?
None whatsoever. And I was thinking back over it, and even the word period was barely mentioned. And I think it's a generational thing. Well, my belief is that it's a generational thing. And I grew up in the 70s, and so many of these topics that we're now beginning to broach, we just never spoken about. I think if we're not talking about the beginning of our menstrual journeys, it's highly unlikely that we're going to be talking about the end. So no, it was absolutely never discussed. I think the landscape is shifting though, and it's certainly something that I see. With the period positivity movement, I think the generation that follows behind me and probably yourself are far more vociferous. I think they're far more experienced in advocating for themselves and advocating for others. And I think that's just absolutely marvelous. Really, more power to them.
Oh, I completely agree. When I was in primary school and high school, periods were mentioned and we were educated about them, but I don't think the menopause was mentioned apart from once. It was mentioned that it would occur, and it wasn't mentioned what it was or how it worked or what that even meant. It was just, and then someday the menopause will happen, and you kind of go, what's that?
It comes back to almost this absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. I think the fact that we weren't talking about it can almost give the impression that, you know, it wasn't an issue, or it wasn't a problem, or it wasn't a significant event in somebody's lives. Whereas I think, you know, that's really very far from the truth for many of us.
Would you mind telling us how your experience with the menopause started?
I went through an early menopause at the age of 41, and that was as a result of surgery. Up until about the age of 38, I'd had really difficult gynecological health. I'd had issues around endometriosis, ovarian cysts. Around, as I say, 38, 39, I started to get a lot of discomfort on top of, you know, the endometriosis pain. It was discovered I had some pretty large and rapidly growing fibroids, which sort of really forced the issue for me, because it was becoming uncomfortable to move about. I couldn't bend over and do my shoelaces up, and it was really impacting my quality of life. So I went for a hysterectomy and had my ovaries removed, which of course put me immediately into surgical menopause. And I had not a clue what was going on. I thought I would leave hospital, we're told roughly 6 to 8 weeks, you'll be fine, back to work. Menopause wasn't mentioned, and I think because I was so focused on just getting the surgery out of the way, it never occurred to me that menopause would be an issue. And if I think about what I knew of the topic, I knew to expect hot flushes and possibly night sweats. And because I wasn't experiencing any of those at the time, never occurred to me the whole raft of issues that I was experiencing was simply as a result of menopause. And that's something I hear quite often. And I take full responsibility for my lack of knowledge, my lack of awareness, because if it were anything else, I would read up about it. So I think landscape is changing and we're becoming more aware. Certainly if you look at, you know, the popular media, sometimes we can't move for a menopause article, which is great. It's about raising awareness, because I would prefer it that somebody else doesn't have to follow or doesn't follow in the same footsteps that I took.
It sounds from what you're saying that there was a cultural emphasis, maybe unspoken emphasis, that this wasn't really something you had to look into or worry about. So do you think that might have influenced your decision about the research you did going into the surgery?
I think you're right. Yeah, absolutely. And quite why there's just this, whether it's a gendered issue, I don't know. I try not to look at everything through a gendered lens, but it just seems very strange to be completely unprepared for it. I mean, the information I left hospital with was just two pieces of information. Refrain from sex for 6 weeks and don't lift anything heavier than a kettle of water for the same duration. And both vital pieces of information, but I was not prepared for the insomnia, the mood swings. I suppose my body was in essence in shock from the surgery, because it's pretty major surgery, irrespective of whether, you know, it's a laparoscopic or open abdominal. It all involves the same sort of work within the pelvic region.
Did you notice that there was a significant difference between the pre-surgery care, the care you received with your team in the hospital, and the aftercare?
The care I had in hospital was absolutely first class, a really fantastic ward. And from seeing the gynae consultant to surgery, it was 5 weeks, which in itself is incredible. So that was really, really swift. There was no aftercare is probably the best way to describe it. And again, this is something that I hear from others going through similar surgery. It's almost as if the surgeon, they play their part, they do the surgery, and understandably that's where their job ends. You're then just sent out into the wider world, I suppose. I don't quite know why there isn't any follow-up, because I know with certain other surgeries, I spoke to somebody recently, they had their gallbladder removed and they were given regular follow-ups. It's a bit of a mystery. But given the extent of the surgery and given the impact, not just on my physical health, but my mental health, I think that added to just the general stress, because I felt vulnerable, I felt isolated. Also because the general consensus around recovery times, 6 to 8 weeks, you may be okay externally from 6 to 8 weeks, but there's a huge amount of healing and you know, again, if you have an abdominal incision, if you think about all of the muscles and the deep layers have to knit together, that's not something that happens in a hurry. So it was really just a massive shock to my system in so many ways. Aftercare was left really in my hands, I suppose. And I wish I had been better prepared before surgery, because then I would have. I mean, there are so many things that you take for granted that you just can't do. I could, you know, again, I still couldn't bend over because you've got the abdominal swelling, and walking was uncomfortable. Stairs were difficult. I couldn't open the shower door, because it's amazing the contribution your pelvic floor plays to really simple things. 6 weeks after surgery, I tried to grate cheese and I couldn't do it because there's literally no strength. And it's the impact is sort of really wide-reaching.
It sounds like there was not only an incredible physical toll on you in that, but it sounds like there was a mental one. Before your surgery and the onset of medical menopause, Did you notice a difference between your mental health then and your mental health afterwards?
I'd navigated depression since my mid-teens and to some extent anxiety, but I didn't speak about them because I was really, I suppose I was ashamed. And I thought if I just ignore them and deny them, then everything will be fine. But as we know, these things don't go away. And after surgery, it was the mental health aspects that I think floored me. I mean, looking back, I can now see it very clearly. The anxiety spiked. My mood deteriorated quite quickly. And then the suicidal ideation popped up. Not helped, of course, by the lack of sleep. There's a reason why sleep deprivation is a torture tactic, isn't it? Because I think everything becomes so much harder when you're not sleeping. So my mental health, yeah, was significantly impacted. And that's probably the cruel irony of perhaps depression. For me, when I'm in it, A, I don't realise quite how bad I am. I also lose the ability for rational thought and sort of logical reasoning. I then was not able to deal with the physical issues as better as I would have been, because of course I was emotionally and mentally so unwell. There's a reason why the suicide rate in women in England peaks around the 40, I think it's the 49 to 55 age bracket. And I think obviously there are many other factors that feed into that, but I don't think it's entirely coincidental. A lot of the people I speak to going through perimenopause in particular, it's the anxiety that really starts to become problematic. Before the last couple of years, that aspect of menopause really wasn't spoken about. Yes, we were getting used to talking about the hot flushes and night sweats. We talk about those, that's okay. But I really don't think we were talking about the mental health side of it, definitely not as a severe end. Paranoia, and as I say, the suicidal ideation, which is frightening, I think, and it's also perplexing. I mean, it's definitely for people that you live with, because it must be then terribly hard for them to try and figure out what on earth is going on.
Did you seek out the menopause cafe for a particular reason during this time?
I went along to the very first Menopause Cafe that was held in Perth, and that was in June 2017. I had, I think, really reached a crisis point in that I just didn't know what was going on. I still hadn't added up the dots at that point, so I still didn't realise that everything was, or the majority of my issues were due to menopause. It was the day before the event. I was scrolling through Twitter, as you do, and I just saw this post come up, and I thought, well, why not? And it was a big deal to go to it, because the social anxiety was really problematic, but something just made me go. I sat at the back, sat glued to my seat. The atmosphere was just amazing in terms of a shared sense of camaraderie, I think, and compassion in the room, but also energy. It was a really uplifting event. That was sort of a really pivotal point in my gradual recovery, again, thanks to Twitter. I saw a message by Dr. Hannah Short, and she mentioned the link between depression and menopause. And so those two things together, you know, it's almost like the light bulbs coming on in my brain. That sort of always was a groundswell to this epiphany of just exactly what was going on.
I'm so glad that was there for you when you needed it. I definitely know what you mean about an energy when you feel like you're in a space around people that maybe you don't know that well, but you feel that they will, maybe for the first time, understand you or at least be able to sympathize with you in a way that maybe other people can't.
It can be so easy, I think, going through the menopausal transition to become isolated in terms of anxiety, social anxiety, meeting people, even driving. That's again something that I hear and became a problem for me. I just became anxious about driving. And, you know, at a time when it would be really helpful to be getting out and meeting people, it's again perhaps a cruel irony that seems to be something that seems to become an issue for so many of us. Talking about it, that's just so important. I left there thinking, A, I'm not going mad, because I'd really begun to wonder, and B, I'm not alone. And I think that is just so powerful.
Isolation is an incredibly powerful aspect, the way we interact as humans, especially because we are, even the most introverted of us, we are group creatures, we're social animals. And so to be in a space where you feel that you cannot relate to the people around you, that they cannot understand you, no wonder that creates such a mental stressor. The idea that we might be ejected from the community, just that's a base primal fear.
Absolutely. And if you think about the work of Bruce Perry, when he's talking about, you know, the degree of our connectedness is a far better predictor of our ability to stay well and to remain well. I think it's connection is a biological imperative, isn't it? And I think that's never truer than when going through any transition. But I think the menopause transition, where we don't really have a choice about it. And yes, I had a choice about mine. So I think in some respects, I had a slightly easier route to menopause in that I knew exactly when mine would start. Whereas if you're going through a gradual menopause, you really sometimes you don't have a clue, and you may go 8 or 9 months without a period, think you're on the finishing straight, and then you get a bleed. So it's it's a tumultuous time, and I think it can be a very vulnerable time in somebody's life.
You have created and continue to work with support group for menopause. So could you tell us a little bit more about that group that you facilitate?
It's called Pause. The Twitter handle is menopause_aces. I facilitate it with Anish DeVos. We both came to the realization that we certainly weren't talking about menopause within trauma spheres. Up until a couple of years ago, within the menopause world, we weren't talking about trauma. And it's almost as if you've got these two taboos. I might have thought that they would meld and come together quite well, but how I perceive what goes on is that the menopause world is still just a bit awkward. I'm not too sure we want to go down the trauma stuff. Speaking from my own experiences as a trauma survivor, the thought of having to deal with yet something else, i.e. menopause, I really didn't want to think about that either. There's so much shame, I think, around trauma, irrespective of its individual root. And again, menopause, I think there's still an awful lot of shame there. And you put the two together, it's just a completely baffling barrier. So Anish and I decided to run, it's an online support group over Zoom, and we meet on the first Wednesday of the month. And it's simply a safe space where like-minded souls come together in a compassionate environment, share stories, provide support. And it's really very simple. But I think there was definitely a need for that.
Do you think there's a link between menopause and long-term trauma in a way that maybe isn't being explored?
I do. And that is a fascinating point, because it's starting to be explored more over the last couple of years. But even back to 2001, and then again in 2008, there were a couple of studies that showed women who had early life adversity and childhood abuse, childhood trauma, had a greater burden of menopause symptoms, particularly the vasomotor ones. So I'm talking about the hot flushes and the night sweats. And very, very recently, last year, there was another study that came out that showed a history of ACEs, i.e. adverse childhood experiences, again, 4 or more ACEs resulted in a significantly increased symptom burden across the full range. So we're talking psychosexual, bladder issues, skin, muscle, everything. And that was really the first study that showed it doesn't just have an impact on hot flushes and night sweats, but it really puts women at risk when they go through the transition. And it's trying to find a way to raise awareness of that, I think, without adding to the overall stress and anxiety that I think can come with living with a history of any early life adversity.
Why do you think there is a palpable silence around the menopause, at least historically, that people are having to work against now?
My feeling is that shame lies at the root of it. That underpins a lot of certainly the historical narrative. And if we think about the work of the Texan researcher, Dr. Brené Brown, she always says that shame thrives in secrecy and silence. So if we're not talking about something, I think that adds to the whole groundswell of shame and misinformation. Because if we're not getting clear guidance or clear information about something, I think it's very easy to then have it misreported, which is not helpful. That is why it is so important to be A, having this conversation, but also having the conversations elsewhere. It can be very easy to sort of approach them with a comedic angle or in a way in which we intend to shock. And I think that's not necessarily the way to engage people. I think we can approach the subject being pragmatic and just being open and always being, I think, cognizant of listening to those with lived experience, because that's where I think you get a truly authentic and pragmatic picture of the transition.
Are there things that you would like to see put in place to support people experiencing the menopause?
My first one would be if funding were absolutely no issue, because I think we have to be wary of the fact, mindful of the fact that resources are limited. Firstly, I would like within every GP practice to have a dedicated menopause nurse. I think that would be enormously helpful. And secondly, again, if funding were no issue, I would like every person that needs it to have access to appropriate specialist counselling. By that, I mean by a trained counsellor or therapist. Being more realistic, firstly, I would like everyone who needs it to be able to access effective and appropriate treatment, whether that's HRT. And at the moment, there is considerable anxiety around supply issues. It can really be extremely impactful. Secondly, testosterone can be particularly useful for those of us in early or surgical menopause. It's not just about improving libido. For me, it improves my motivation, it improves my energy cognitively, it improves my focus. So for me, testosterone is a very, very important part of my hormone replacement regime. And thirdly, I'd like to see a greater focus on just a holistic approach, so that we are encompassing the full hormonal trajectory, whereby in a womb to tomb, which encompasses diet, lifestyle, exercise, medication, and all of those, and really sort of seeing it as very much a holistic package, rather than this woman is having issues because of whether it's endometriosis or whatever else it may be, just really widening the lens to really include the full scope. And this is where I think we're really fortunate in Scotland with the Women's Health Plan that came out last year, that from 2021 to 24, obviously the proof is going to be in the delivery, but I think it's really ambitious, but it's a really optimistic program. And I think it sends an important message, not just to those of us in Scotland, but in the UK as well. There is a lot of doom and gloom around menopause, but I think things are gradually changing. And I think it's a better time to be going through menopause now than perhaps it would have been Even 5 years ago, I think.
What would you say to somebody who was beginning their menopause journey and was coming to you to discuss that?
Find out as much as you possibly can in advance. By advance, I mean anytime really after 35, because I think so many of us start the perimenopause transition much, much sooner than perhaps we may think. And if I look at my own circumstances, I went through menopause at 41. Looking back, I can recognise that I was already well in perimenopause, even before that stage. So I think forewarned is forearmed. And we always think that menopause is going to happen way, way down the line. But I think the more we know about it, the sooner, the better. And there were some fantastic websites with evidence-based information. Rock My Menopause is a particularly good one. And if you're going through early menopause or premature ovarian insufficiency, the DAISY Network, they have some really very, very helpful resources. Other advice, I would say, be prepared to try as many different solutions, whether that's medications or lifestyle or diet or whatever it is. And don't isolate, try and try and stay connected and talk about it. Finally, be kind to yourself. I think that is so super important. And I know it's easier said than done, but I think a little bit of self-compassion goes a long way. And also know that it will get better. There is light at the end of the tunnel when, with the right support and with everything in place, it really can be a very good time to flourish. Postmenopausal zest is a thing, and it can be a really positive time with the right support.
Thank you so much. That is a very encouraging and helpful message. I always find it useful to have an action plan. I know that not everyone is wired like that. For me, it's better to have something to be doing. So an area to be looking into. It's about finding the method that works best for you as an individual, whether that's medication or lifestyle or a combination of all the different options.
Absolutely. I was trying to think, what is the saying? Plan for the worst, hope for the best. I think that's definitely the way forward.
Thank you so much for speaking to us. It's been such an informative chat. If people would like to hear more from you, where can they go?
The best place to find me is Twitter. If it's for the Menopause and Aces, our Twitter handle is @menopause_aces. If somebody wants to contact me about surgical menopause, my other Twitter handle is @SirMeno_NYTM. And I usually lurk on one of those too.
Fantastic. And if people want to read more from you as an author, is it a similar space they go to?
They can find the Surgical Menopause book over on Twitter. That is the best place to connect.
Thank you so much for speaking to us. It's been such a joy.
Well, thank you so much again, once again, Rosie, because it's really so important that we sort of get this message out.
Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to appear in the podcast, or if you need assistance with your podcast, then get in touch by email, podcasts@mindwavesnews.com.